You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cuss.
All right, folks. Hey, welcome to another episode. And I'm excited to invite my old friend. I've talked about him a lot on the show, but I don't know that you've ever been on the show, Jimmy Carnes.
Yeah, so glad to be here.
This is your first time on the show, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. You're not really a guest, so kind of a future co-host. So we're going to light our candle. The rule is if somebody's a guest, I don't light the candle. I don't know why I made this rule, by the way. But I started with solo episodes, lighting a candle to help people in an audio podcast remember God's presence.
Yeah.
And then Lisa joined me for some, and it's like, well, she's not really a guest, so we're lighting a candle. So I grant you that same privilege, Jimmy. This is the Sage Teakwood candle. Smells all right. So folks, just wherever you're listening to this podcast, you know, if you're on a treadmill or out with your dog or in a car, the candle that we do here is just a simple way to trip over God's love. So Jimmy, I'll just ask you right away, where's a way that you've tripped over God's love in the last week or two?
You know, I think I grabbed it from one of your podcasts, you know, that part where we talk about when do you feel most loved. And for me, one of the things that's on my list is a hug from my kids.
Right.
And so it's amazing how much of a difference it is that I get hugs from my kids on a daily basis, which I'm incredibly grateful for. But to just use that as a trigger to remind myself of just God's favor and love that he's showing me through my own kids is, yeah, you can't help but run into that on a regular basis.
Yeah. How old are your kids now?
7 and 10.
Yeah. The biggest surprise to me is like my oldest is 22. I've got a 19-year-old and a 16-year-old. I just didn't think they'd still want to be around us.
Yeah.
And they're not quite as exuberant with the hugs as when they were little.
Yeah.
But it's still an amazing thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. That works.
Yeah.
We're both fellow guitarists. We get great pleasure out of music.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, so we have been talking on the show about differentiation. The last episode, I just did a little bender on differentiation on the screen, and we talked about Toy Story, the movie Spotlight, Hidden Figures.
Yeah.
But what have you been watching lately where you think, oh, there's an interesting case of differentiation?
Yeah, I just watched Sea Beast with my son. He watched it for the second time so that I could watch it with him. And there's a little girl in the show, and she's the main character, and I was pretty struck by her differentiation and that she didn't have a lot of power being a young kid. It's a movie that's set in the old times where there's pirates. And so these pirates are out and they're hunting these huge beasts of the sea, and she stows away. And over the course of the movie, just doesn't waver in what she believes to be true. And she holds true to her voice and does the whole declarative I statement thing in the face of some pretty opposing opposition, you know, big manly pirates and kings and queens and such. And so it was pretty striking.
Yeah. And she was just a little girl in this situation. And if I remember right, you were saying that there's something about the beast that might be, like she used curiosity, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a pretty new movie and you always hate to spoil them, but I think that it's kind of a...
I'm fearless about spoiling movies.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that you probably get it by the trailer that there's something, you know, amiss here with them hunting these beasts, but they come up across the most vicious of the beasts and it doesn't kill them. And so they actually save the beast's life. And I guess somehow the beast is able to recognize that. And so there's this kind of friendship that they develop without words. And so she challenges what they've been told about their whole history and succeeds.
Okay. Well, I've been excited for some time to bring you on the show because we've been working together for a long time, since 2012, and particularly on these tools for quite a number of years. And so kicking off, I'm not sure when we're going to start, but August, September, you'll be a sometime host on the show, and we're actually going to go into detail on some of these tools together just to help our listeners. We're actually in some ways not going to reset, but particularly for our old-time listeners, we're actually going to start right at the beginning. And just even say things like, what's anxiety?
Yeah.
And what are the spaces? So I'm excited about that. It'd be fun to do together.
Yeah, me too.
But it might be helpful for people to hear a bit of your own journey. So how did you get into all this?
Yeah, we go back 2012 when I first came to Discovery and came on staff there, met you, and you grabbed a few of us and said, man, there's this thing that I learned back in chaplaincy, and I want to know if I can teach it in a less intense environment, because of course you learned it in quite an intense environment.
Right.
And so could it be taught to us that obviously we had our own trenches to go through together, but different. And so, yeah, I was a part of your guinea pig group back then so many years ago. And then learn some tools that completely changed the way that I showed up as a leader. I know that's a bold statement, but I recognized that there was things that I was doing that was motivated by my own anxiety. And actually, to be honest, the first thing I did was I felt like the movie Inside Out, where there were these control systems inside, and I felt like I just needed to shut them all down. Because when I inspected them, they were just all tangled with anxiety and mixed motives. And over the years and encountering the material, I've obviously learned how to re-engage, turn those systems back on. And, you know, a 3 out of 10 with this stuff is a raging success.
Yeah.
And recognizing how much relief can come from some hard work, looking at introspective work on why we're motivated to do what we do, and the effect that we have not only on the people around us, but the people around us have on us. So, I mean, I have so many words to say that on that topic, but the short story is when I learned to pay attention to the way that anxiety moves in a group and my position as a leader, the impact that I can have on that group of people, that was a game changer that I'm still learning from today.
So you mentioned earlier that you started by noticing that you were showing up anxious. What would be an example? What would that look like if you're showing up anxious?
Yeah, I think that my biggest focus, especially back then, was what people say or think about me. Especially coming into a role in a church, there are some presumed expectations of the way that you should show up. I was the director of worship arts. And so, just believing that I needed to be what the room needed me to be and just being a slave to that and kind of letting that be more important than anything else, which really limited how effectual I could be. And I didn't have a lot of declarative I statements back in those days.
Something that's interesting, when we first started that guinea pig class, the question we were all wondering is church leadership traumatic enough to generate the need for this class, right? Like I remember we were all chatting about, well, Steve learned it in like the intensive care in the emergency room where there's life and death.
Yeah.
But could it be that church leadership generates its own like trauma? Turns out, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you really cut your teeth on wrangling a bunch of different musicians who are all wired differently and have different needs in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the creative space sometimes gets a bad rap, you know, because of the stereotypical creatives can be sometimes difficult. And I don't know that that would be my assessment this many years in, but I would say that it is a unique skill set to take a group of people that have a passion towards music, a passion for God, each with their different expertise and skill set, and bring them all together to make a service happen. I'm a generalist. I work with a lot of people who are much better than I am at each of their trades and gifts. But my unique skill set was bringing them all together.
Yeah. All right. So Thursday night was typically the worship rehearsal time. How long did it take to notice when someone walked in the door if they needed you to diffuse or you had to manage their anxiety or something, you know, something like that? Like someone walks in, how many seconds or microseconds do you need? And you're like,
Man, it feels like you'd have to have a stopwatch that could go into the several decimal places in because it's immediate. Sometimes it's projected. You kind of assume because of relational history that somebody's just going to wear their emotions on their sleeve and you just know that they're going to be a force to be reckoned with. And so some of that's probably even before they open the door. It's my worry. Mm-hmm. But outside of those scenarios, absolutely, you can just kind of feel it. I'm a feeler as well. I don't know if that has to do with my Enneagram wiring or just my family of origin, but when I'm in the same space as something, I generally am aware of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what are a couple of tools that you practice? Like you're a feeler. You're also a perfectionist or a recovering perfectionist, probably the best way to say it.
Yeah.
What are a couple of tools that help you either Thursday night or before we go out on a Sunday to really center yourself and give yourself to God and be less wrapped up in all of that?
Oh man, what a great question. I know that early on it was easier because I came into my role at Discovery without a lot of experience. Yeah. I mean, really not much at all. And so it was pretty easy.
How many times had you led worship before I gave you that job?
Depends on how you qualify that question. I had helped a handful of times at my church in Florida, but never with that role on my shoulders.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So just a Starbucks coffee and off to the races at Discovery.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the question being, what are some tools? Again, early on, there wasn't an external expectation for me to be excellent, I didn't think. Nobody would have expected me to know what I was doing early on. But then as the years rolled on, I should start to know what I'm doing. And so I couldn't rely on that excuse anymore. But what's kind of fun or fascinating is that really this candle that you just lit for us has been recently a huge relief of mine of trying to show up human-sized. And so that expertise that now I think I'm supposed to have in a lot of ways works against me because then I think I'm supposed to be better than I am. And just whether it's right before I get on stage, I don't normally light a candle, but it's the same idea of kind of reminding myself that God only expects me to be human size. And so all the things that I'm carrying in with me, just trying my best at any moment is all that God expects. And obviously that plays into my expertise as well. Obviously, that comes with excellence because of my history, but I'm also allowed to be human. So for me, it's relaxing because when I watch Wheel of Fortune and I, think, man, how can you not see the answer on the board? But it's so much easier to do that on the couch than being in the studio.
In the moment, yeah.
And I'm that way. If I feel the pressure of the studio, I clamp up and nothing comes out. And so for me, learning to relax, then I surprise myself because God's actually able to work in me and through me without a lot of resistance.
It does bring up a question about Vanna White. Like, I'm not a Wheel of Fortune aficionado, but you brought it up.
Yeah, so we have
to go there.
Yep.
Okay. Up until what, 15, 20 years ago, she actually had to physically turn a letter.
Yeah.
So she could have had like a repetitive strain injury or pull a muscle or something. But now she just, does she even touch it or does she just point at it?
You know, I haven't watched it recently enough to speak authoritatively on this, but yeah, it is funny because she at least goes over and appears to touch it.
She walks near it.
Yeah, yeah.
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 I have thought longer about Vanna White than I would be comfortable admitting, but just I've wondered about what must it be like that's what you've done with your whole life. But of course, she has charities and she's using her platform to serve in many ways. But it is, I don't know. I couldn't do it.
I would like to be in the room when they decided to have her continue to go and touch the squares when they no longer needed her to turn them.
We don't need her to turn them anymore, but we still need Vanna.
Right. What is she going to do?
I mean, it's partly because Pat Sajak does need a bit of a softening. Like, she's a good softener to him.
Yeah, I'm not saying it was a bad decision. Yeah. I just would have liked to have heard that back and forth.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, hey, we actually do have a topic today. Like what I want to talk about, Jimmy, is what do we understand leadership is that makes us anxious? What is it really that relaxes us? I think you and I would both say, the thing we think leadership is that generates anxiety is we think it means we're supposed to know what to do. And so both of us came into roles where we'd really had very little experience and to figure it out as we go. But a lot of our leadership anxiety is the belief that we should know better by now or we should be good at something we've never done before. So what we want to kick around is the dichotomy between the false belief that leadership is knowing what to do versus what we think is true belief, leadership is taking responsibility. Maybe let me get your reaction to that first.
Yeah, I think that resonates well with me, especially with what we were just talking about, me walking into a role where I'm wrangling musicians, many of which, I mean, our drummer had been drumming longer than I've been alive. So lots of expertise there.
And he has a college degree in music.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so being able to lead people who are older than me, but also know more than I do, my lack of musical education. But at the end of the day, somebody needed to keep us on schedule. They needed to make a call on whether or not we needed to move on. This song is as far as we're going to get it tonight, and make some decisions on how to hit the target of producing a service on Sunday that didn't get too much in the way of people coming to encounter God.
What's the time when you have had to make a decision, because you're the leader, whether you feel equipped to or not? Do you have a specific example that comes to mind?
Oh, man. It almost feels like there's so many that I can't find one. It's like, surely there's one that, but this is me being a perfectionist and making sure that it is hitting the target. Is it a big enough decision? I think that navigating the hire for our next worship arts director. So when I took over operations, we needed to hire a new worship arts person. And just weighing, you know, do we wait for more candidates? Do we pull the trigger to the one that we have? And this is not our most recent search, but we had one before. And just, how do you know? How do you know if we need to wait for somebody that we think is a better fit? How do we know if this is the right person for the job when you know so little about a candidate? That's probably an example where a decision needed to be made and shoot, I don't know. I don't know, you know, what to do.
Yeah. I think we've built a context in our church where we not only give permission to not know what to do, we actually generally encourage it. Like I'm thinking of the time I made Brendan run a labyrinth subcommittee. We were going to build a labyrinth on the property. Brendan was a college intern, and we made sure to put on his subcommittee someone with a master's in project management, a landscape architect, so that he could learn to not know what to do in the details, but take responsibility, for example. So I feel like in some ways we've built that culture for a long time, and part of it is out of self-interest. I think this will help all of us kind of keep our jobs, I guess.
Yeah.
But it does feel like if you believe that leadership is knowing what to do, the temptation to exaggerate, lie, hide is higher. Where have you seen that? Whether it's at our church or anywhere, where have you seen that at play?
I think that, you know, my background being a director of worship arts, a lot of these will go back to music. But one of the things that I found pretty early on is that I thought that an audition was scary language. And so I would actually not call it an audition. Like, hey, let's just get together and play through some songs and see where you're at. And then I would find myself frustrated that people weren't treating it like an audition, which is hilarious. Awesome. But I think that what I was trying to avoid was your exact point of people feeling like they needed to pretend they were better than they were to get on the team. When I first came to Discovery, the requirements we had listed on our website of what you needed to be on the team, I was like, shoot, I wouldn't be able to be on the team. Mm. And so in trying to swing the other way, I tried to avoid that to where people would try and say, oh yeah, I can play lead guitar in any key or whatever the case may be. But I would much rather just get a real assessment of where they're at so that we can, you know, make a plan of how to help them succeed with wherever they're at versus them feeling like they needed to pretend.
Mm. Yeah, and I think if we're not trying to be an expert and we're just trying to be responsible, it does give us a way to be human-sized. Look, I'm just a human being trying to do the best I can. The other thing I like about it is it kind of disarms bully-type critics. If they're trying to show how like incompetent you are or how you don't know enough, one of the tools we teach is chasing people to the bottom. What does that make you think of? Or maybe for people who aren't familiar with chasing to the bottom, maybe you could define that for us.
Oh man, that's a tough one for me, Steve, because I know that you've told me, I think right when I started, I was a pretty hat in hand type of person. And so there was a way that, whether it was lack of confidence or the way that I was wired, I would just kind of walk in being really ready to admit that I wasn't the expert in the room.
Yeah, maybe too deferential.
Yeah, and the potential for somebody for that to be like, you know, blood in the water for a shark of them to take advantage of me. And I don't know that I found that pitfall particularly, but it's always been easiest for me. I would much rather you assume that I'm not as competent and let me prove you wrong. And the way that I show up and your actual perception of me informs my credibility is always the route that I'd rather take. And whether that's right or wrong, it definitely avoids a lot of those pitfalls of, you know, people pretending. It's such a terrible thing to have somebody recruit you and you believe that they can do this thing, like they're the captain of the ship, let's say, if we're going back to the sea beast, and trust me, I can take us there, and then they really can't.
Yeah.
I'd rather the opposite happen, of go onto a boat to where we're all trying to figure this out together, and holy cats, this guy, the captain, he actually knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
I don't know what to make of that exactly, but that's definitely my disposition.
Yeah, there's so many public leaders since 2018. I don't know what happened with 2018, but that's like when this unveiling of famous Christian leaders started becoming exposed.
Mm.
Very well-known people we would consider in some ways pillars of their category, like somebody who really built Christian leadership or Christian apologetics. And then we discover they have this secret life. It all comes immediately tumbling down. And it feels to me, my simple assessment would be two things. One is, somewhere along the way, they believe they had to be the expert.
Yeah.
They didn't allow themselves to be human. But the second thing that to me this opens up is, they didn't believe that they had to be well in order to lead well. This is a big thing that we teach. Maybe in some ways, maybe the number one thing we teach is, if you want to infect others with being well, you have to be well. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think that especially in the church, not only is there the just regular human propensity to act like you have it all figured out, the imposter syndrome, somebody else is going to come along who actually knows what they're doing and kick me out of here. But there's also the expectation that's put upon you by the people when they see you as a pastor or the director of worship arts or whatever the role may be. I was just talking about this today with one of my direct reports. When you work for a church, people just kind of puts you in a category, whether it's true or not. And so it's like a double whammy of not only am I competent, but am I moralistically the way this person views me to be? And without shortchanging either of those categories, you can actually be human size. And it doesn't mean that, immorality is okay, that you're always pursuing the goal of excellence or morality, but it's a more real assessment of where we're at. Yeah. And that's the only way that you can improve, is when you actually have an adequate assessment of where you're at. If we're pretending, then it's problematic. So to your question of actually being well, it's not a fake it till you make it scenario, I don't think. And if you do, then it creates a divide that only grows with your success in being able to fake it till you make it. And then it gets so big that it's insurmountable. And you're like, well, now if I come clean, like there's no way forward.
There's no way Armageddon. I can do it.
Yeah.
I think that is what happened with some of these people. Most of them got caught decades into their ministry, but decades earlier, they started making some decisions or hiding some things.
Yeah.
And then they got more and more famous, and then they feel trapped, right?
Yeah.
It's quite, I mean, as much as many of them have done horrifically abusive things, there's also some empathy for them because they're lost. They can't actually, they don't believe at least that they can repent.
Yeah.
It's quite tragic. You mentioned being on church staff, people put us in a different category. I've noticed, at least in my role, the more Bible I know and the more my ability to make meaning of the Bible, the more credit you give me in my spiritual health. Is that the same for a worship leader, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that there is this kind of lumped bucket we get put in. If you're on the stage of a church, they just kind of assume some things about you. And so, I think that the difference between my role and the lead pastor's is that though I'm not opening the Bible and interpreting scripture and using, my education in Greek, which I don't have any, in a lot of ways, it's still a different version of the same thing. You know, I'm choosing the words that we're using to connect with the creator of the universe. And people can, whether it was any actual foresight of mine, of any tactical, like, oh, this is what we need to sing, because God can work through music and lyric, and even in spite of us, people will have a connection with God and then attribute it to, oh, well, it must be because he is so connected with God that now I just get swept up into it with him.
Yeah.
And that's just not always true. And I mean, one of the things that people have reflected about me is that they can see how I get lost in a song or am emotionally reacting to the words that I'm singing, and that's all true.
Yeah.
But even that can happen transactionally, and the rest of the week, my life can be terrible. So there's a lot of assumption that I think comes with just taking the stage of a church.
Yeah. So a lot of what we practice with leadership is making sure people know we're human-sized. It just saves a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And then it feels like you can lead for a long time if your job is to be responsible and not necessarily know everything. Then, so what I'm reflecting on, Jimmy, is leading through COVID would be a great example. Like, we had to make decisions about, do we open the church, do we close it? I remember the one year we had reopened the church, and then we realized we can't fit everyone in for Easter. And we actually closed for Easter. You remember that? Wasn't that long ago?
Yeah.
I don't know how much pushback, I don't know if we've ever talked about this, how much pushback you got. I got a ton of pushback on that. Even from people, you know, who I consider dear friends, they felt robbed. Like, yeah. And then they also felt like us being wise with health safety was some kind of comment on the power of the resurrection, right? Yeah. Like, Jesus rose from the dead, we'll be fine, that kind of idea.
Right.
But at the end of the day, whether that decision was right or wrong, I personally think it was the right decision, we were responsible. We just have to own it. Okay, but then over time, we do grow in wisdom. Like, I think scripture would call us fools if we were responsible for 10 years, but never learning and growing. How does a leader seek wisdom and learn from their mistakes?
I think that probably one of the most important things for me is that when you don't need to be the expert in the room, then you can surround yourself with experts.
Okay.
And I think that it works. It's almost like a snowball effect, to where if you believe that you need to be the one that has all the answers, then there's no room for people that know more than you do. They won't stick around. And if you're not asking them for advice, then you're not learning anything more than you already know. So we really are at the mercy of the pinnacle of the human intellect. And we have different amounts and aptitudes and that kind of thing. But a single human, the smartest one among us, is going to be less effectual than one that's going to, you know, learn from people that are wired differently, that have different experiences. And so, yeah, I think it's the learning posture that's both of the things we're talking about. It's if you believe that a leader needs to know what to do, God help us, because there's not a single person that's going to be able to make those decisions. And the ways that we've set up, you know, structures that are supposed to help with this, with advisors and things like that. Like, it's not uncommon for you to have people in your life that help you make decisions, but it really comes down to the disposition you have. You know, if your whole life is trying to prove that you're the leader that everybody thinks that you are, then it just automatically shortens your ability to learn, because you can't afford to look like you don't have the answer. And you're going to look like you don't have the answer if you're asking somebody else to some degree.
Yeah. Before you and I met, Jeff was the chair of our elders. I would rate Jeff's leadership over me as one of the best leaders who developed me, my boss, really. And I've been thinking about this lately, this idea of, okay, leaders don't know what to do. They're the ones that take responsibility. They learn from their mistakes. And kind of like when you said that you showed up early hat in hand and therefore kind of attracted strong opinions, Jeff called me on that, where he's like, look, you're bringing decisions to the elder board. You're asking us to weigh in on things we've never thought about. We're driving home from work. We're just now starting to think about church. You've been living and breathing church for hours that week. But in your lack of confidence, you want to know what we think, but you don't give us time to think about it.
Yeah.
And then when we tell you what we think, you get frustrated that it's so half-baked, right?
Yeah.
This was so helpful to me. I didn't know I was doing this. And so there is something about being responsible. There's a balance, right? The capacity to poll the room, listen to the voices, but I don't know how to say it, Jim. I'm not quite sure what I'm even asking, but rest in the confidence that, look, God's put me here, right or wrong. And I guess what I'm saying is sometimes I owe the people in the room the relief that I'm going to make the call.
Mm. Yeah.
Whereas I tended to go overboard in wanting everyone's input and almost like a democracy. And it was surprising to me to learn that if I wanted to manage anxiety well, I could relax my people by being more dictatorial to, if that makes sense. Hey, let me make this call. It's my job to make the call. And that's what Jeff was telling me. He's like, listen, some of these jobs, this is why we pay you. Make the call. We'll support you.
Yep.
What's your reaction when you hear about that? What do you think?
Yeah, it's so funny because, I mean, I had 100 thoughts while you were talking, right? And it really comes down to so many things we talk about are about balance, right?
Yeah.
And it's the short, trite answer is that, oh, well, it's just about balance. But it's so insidious that because depending on where we sit, we hear something as the opposite side of the aisle.
Right.
And so this advice of, you know, make sure that you're surrounded by people who are smarter than you, coming from a personality type, is exactly what they might need to hear to find balance. And then somebody who doesn't have any confidence in their ability to make decisions, it's consensus leadership, and they're not leading at all. They're facilitating, yeah. Yeah. Right? And that there's a weakness to that as well. So yeah, I hear in your what you were talking about is just the pursuit of balance of, yeah, recognizing the extremes. And if one of the extremes for the way a wire is leader is I must be viewed as the one who has the answer, and that's a must. It's kind of like Tim Keller, a good thing that becomes an ultimate thing.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to harness your knowledge and make decisions as the leader, but taken to an ultimate thing of saying like, no, if I don't have the answer, it means I'm not the leader that people think that I am,
yeah,
or that I think that I am, gets us on a track to try and cover up and be larger than human size. I think that's it. It's where we believe we're supposed to be larger than human sized, and we can't be. So we have to fudge the gap.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking about this in real time, even as I'm listening to you, like I'm trying to formulate, I'm not quite sure what point I'm bringing across, but maybe let's try this. I have been in meetings where I wish the leader was way less collaborative,
mm-hmm,
because we're all like, just tell us what to do. We just, yeah, want to know what to do. And I have been that leader this is getting a little nuanced, but because one of my idols or my proclivities is to want to be the smartest guy in the room, then with these elders swinging the pendulum so far where I actually was the smartest guy in the room on that issue.
Right.
Because I was trained and I've got experience in it. And they just want me to tell them what we should do. But I'm more hung up on my issues that I'm wasting their time.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. I think that makes sense.
Yeah. Pretty nuanced. So I guess what we're saying is the idea is that a healthy leader is one that focuses more on taking responsibility more than knowing what to do. And then connected to that, a healthy leader is faithful. Faithful to their people, faithful to integrity. Like when we talk about leadership mistakes, we're always talking about mistakes that don't end up in jail, right? Like just everyday human mistakes. We're not talking about character traits or secret addictions or things like that.
Yeah, and I think that's where faithfulness and even longevity is where some of that evens out, right? So as you look at the pitfalls or the mistakes that happen, there's relational currency, there's trust that comes with a faithful leader, somebody that is showing up to their post every day, to where the people that are following that leader know they're not perfect.
Yeah.
They're actually usually the best to know exactly where their shadow sides are. The leader often would be wise to ask their direct reports where their blind spots are, because they're usually pretty aware of them, but they follow them anyways. They're not following a perfect leader. They aren't waiting for those things to be corrected before they follow them. That a part of their trust is the longevity, is the faithfulness to the post.
Yeah. So I fear I'm over nuancing, but I'm going to try this one. So, okay. Then the leader is faithful for a long time. They've got employees who are newer to it. At some point, you have to be willing to get it wrong in public. And what I noticed, particularly when we moved into the barn, I'd been around longer than most of the people that worked for me. They kept asking me to make the risky decision so they wouldn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to figure this out. Like in our system series, we're always looking for patterns. And where it really came to a head, one of our precious team members, I really felt bad for her, is I figured out we were doing a pig roast. It was like a fall kickoff that we used to do, right? When we, yep, roast the pig. And she wanted me to tell her how much pig to order. And that's the moment I realized, aha, we're depending on my faithfulness too much, because I'm very happy to make the call because I've become very comfortable with vulnerably getting it wrong. But she has to, at some point, I have to build tension so that she can step into the vulnerability of making the wrong decision about how much pork to order.
Right.
And I remember, I think I was a little testy with her because I think I said something like, oh, I know what's going on. You want me to run us out of pork. You don't want to run us out of pork. And what I was meaning to say is this is a pivot. This is a fork in the road. So you are quite famous on our staff for developing young leaders. When do you let them fail when they're trying to get you to fail? Does that make sense? Have you had that happen?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I distinctly remember, and this is maybe an over-functioning, under-functioning conversation,
is.
Right?
Yeah.
Of we fall into patterns. And so in this topic, you're talking about, you know, under this idea of you feeling comfortable making the decision, but that really just grew into you took up space to where we no longer needed to fully function because you were making decisions for us.
Yeah.
I remember distinctly with one of my direct reports, they were leading worship on stage. It was actually a rehearsal, but it was going terribly. And I was in the room observing, and they were looking at me going, why aren't you stepping in to fix this? They were furious with me, and I knew it, but I... whether that was the right or wrong decision at that moment. And, you know, it's kind of like how many stones do you put in the river and expect them to jump across? I don't know if the timing was right or whatever, but the intent behind it was the right move of one of these days, I won't be fixing this. And so you've got to figure out how to fix it yourself. And yeah, I mean, that's the art of leadership, right? Is gauging the timing of those things, of going, okay, I've got somebody that is following me through the wilderness, we're crossing the river, and I've jumped across because I've, you know, I'm comfortable with that, but they aren't. And so I turn around and go, why aren't you coming? And they're waiting for me to put a stone in the river, and there's an appropriate time to do that along the path of them learning how to jump themselves. But then there's also the time where you just go, you know what? You can make it. Jump. And I don't know that there's a formula for that.
Yeah, but it is an important thing to notice. We've kicked around a lot of ideas on just the broad topic of leadership, but this is a really crucial thing. I'm thinking of Nancy Ortberg. She describes leadership as elastic bands. And when do you make tension and when do you let people be comfortable? And then my friend Jay Pathak, when we first met, I actually went to him for some leadership advice, and he asked me, he's like, are you always the one putting on the bulletproof vest first through the door? I was like, of course, that's what leaders do. And he says, oh, yeah, no, what I do is I'll tell my people, you're going in first and you're going to get shot first, but I've got your back. It was quite transformative for me.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what we're talking about, is you and I didn't grow until the mistake was fully on our shoulders and until we felt the full weight of the tension of, oh man, like if I don't do this, it's not going to get done. And then the longer experienced leaders hang around, the more tempting it is to hide in their shadow rather than vulnerably make brave moves yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the principle is true regardless, but everybody has different styles on how to go about that. Right. Yeah. And so I'm an Enneagram nerd. And so that plays into how all this plays out of the wiring of the particular leader is going to matter, and the wiring of their direct reports or somebody that's making their way through that path. But what I love about that is that it doesn't change the target. Like, it may change the way you get there.
Or the timing of it.
Yeah, the timing of it. And so that's what's so wonderful about going back to the top of the show of not pretending to be something that you aren't, is that there's so much nuance to navigate with leadership and with handing off leadership to the next generation of leaders, that you can put rules of thumb and you can put targets on the wall, but the way that you get there looks different, and one isn't right and one isn't wrong. But staying grounded with those frameworks is, I think, the key.
Thank you. folks. Hey, every week for the last several weeks, we've been talking about the conference Unlocking Faith, October 2nd through 4th, right here in Colorado. And if you're a new listener, the concept is simple and hopefully life-changing. That's what we're praying for. The simple concept is that we all hold beliefs that are blocking our belief in Jesus. We have these core beliefs that are infecting and getting in the way of our most precious belief, that almost all of us struggle to experience the God that we believe in, the peace of Christ, freedom in Christ, even something so simple as God's love. So if you believe God's love cognitively in your brain, but you've never felt it in your body, if you struggle to feel peace, this is the conference for you. Jimmy will be one of our speakers. Each of us coming will be bringing a key that can help you unlock faith, unlock that thing that is blocking God's love flooding through you. The way I picture it is like releasing a river from a dam, just that you can actually relax into the presence of God. You can join us in person here in Colorado. You can join us live streaming either by yourself, or your congregation can host the conference, or you can buy a live streaming ticket and that'll give you access to watch the videos on demand. CapableLife.me is where you find tickets. Early bird rate ends June 30th. Jimmy, just as we wrap up, you hinted beforehand a couple of things. You said you're an Enneagram nerd. And also, what you're suggesting is that leadership isn't a set of precepts. It's more about being grounded and highly intuitive. Mm. And for you, really, you've really taught a lot of us on how Enneagram can make us more intuitive, how we can... I think it's a lot of the reason you're such a powerful developer of people is you kind of intuitively know how they're wired, what blocks them, what they can manage, and then you just kind of go in and unlock that. Mm. So much is written and talked about on Enneagram. I've had not some jealousy, but I'm like, man, systems theory is like this thing that no one knows about. Everyone's talking about Enneagram. But you've really done something unique with it, I think. I think you've actually made some fresh contribution because you're really integrating Enneagram through the lens of anxiety. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I learned systems theory and then in that same time period got introduced to the Enneagram. So I learned them simultaneously, which is why it just made so much sense. It felt like two different tools that were peeling the same onion. And I just think that, this is going to show my ignorance. Is it Socrates that says the unexamined life isn't
worth living?
Not worth living. That's pretty extreme.
It's one of those Greek dudes.
Yeah, Mitch could set me straight on that.
Yes, our friend Mitch would know that. Yeah.
But anyhow, I think that is the magic, is that tools like systems theory and the Enneagram help us examine the life that we live. And that really is where the magic is. As we're looking for the formula or the magic bullet that will solve all of our problems, one of the things that I love about Capable Life and the work that we do is it's tools that help you examine your life. They help you notice what's going on around you, because humans are innately built to solve problems. And we solve most of them without any help. But because of the way that we're wired, there are certain ways we get stuck. And the things we try and do to get unstuck just make it more stuck. And so having somebody that's outside of that system give you some tools to observe what's going on is a game changer. And so that's been my story with these tools, not only Capable Life, but the Enneagram, is just some frameworks that don't answer it for me, but give me a lens, like almost like I remember back in school, you had the transparencies and you could lay different transparencies over something. I like to think of the Enneagram and systems theory as you've got something that you can see, but then you lay over this transparency and it reveals a map or a framework that helps you see it in a way that your brain can tackle it, whereas before it felt insurmountable.
Mm. Are you a fan of the movie National Treasure by chance, Nicolas Cage?
I am a fan of Nicolas Cage, but I have not seen National Treasure.
You've never seen National Treasure?
No, I'm afraid to admit
okay,
that.
Yeah. So he discovers this map, but then there's these glasses that he has to put on to interpret the map.
Oh,
and
yeah.
As he puts different shades over his eyes, different parts of the map light
That's
up.
That's exactly it. That's I would exactly have used that analogy about. If I had known about it.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, so folks, that's Jimmy Carnes. You're going to be hearing a lot more from Jimmy over the next couple of years as he becomes one of the co-hosts of the Capable Life Managing Leadership Anxiety podcast. Jimmy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.